I was very discouraged and disappointed and disheartened.
They're not allowed to do it because this isn't through the looking glass. They don't get to say a word means whatever they say they want it to mean.
That was when I started sort of yelling at the YouTube, no, that's not what this is about. You know, it's not that at all.
Hi, and welcome to a special edition of Talking Tax on the highly watched Altera case. This is the final episode in a three-part mini-series on Altera Corporation v. Commissioner. I'm Carolina Vargas, a legal editor at Bloomberg Tax.
And I'm Sony Kasem, a reporter at Bloomberg Tax. In our final episode, we recap what went down in the oral arguments between Altera and the IRS, this time in front of a new judge. Which direction will the new judge lean toward? Will Altera finally succeed in the case? Or does Silicon Valley still face billions in taxes?
Intel subsidiary Altera and the IRS defended their positions once again, but this time to a reconstituted three-judge panel in the Ninth Circuit on October 16th.
But there was a little bit of sort of kabuki theater about it, in the sense that the only person really that mattered in the room was Graber, Judge Graber.
That was Barbara Montagani of Montagani Tax in Virginia. She echoed the thoughts of many others, including attorney Patrick Smith, who we'll hear from later.
All eyes were indeed on Judge Susan Graber. She joined the panel to replace deceased Judge Stephen Reinhardt, who died in March. The court had issued its opinion in July. The other two judges hearing the case are Judge Sidney Thomas and Judge Kathleen O'Malley. In the original July opinion, Thomas and Reinhardt sided with the government, and O'Malley had dissented.
Barb said Judge Graber seemed to approach Altera's counsel in a more challenging tone, but she hesitates to read too much into how Judge Graber might ultimately decide whose side she's on.
I can only imagine what it'd be like to end up at the 11th hour being asked to kind of step in and kind of start from the beginning, particularly since there isn't necessarily a level of expertise with the subject matter.
If anything, Judge Graber seemed to place herself in Reinhardt's shoes.
My sense of it is that she probably entered into it with a presumption, and presumption may be too strong, a somewhat of a bias towards hearing it out with the idea that she, unless she hears something that really doesn't make sense to her, that she'll go with the majority.
Biased or not, her line of questioning could indicate which way she is likely to rule.
The point that struck me the most was that she focused with both the government lawyer and with Altera's lawyer on the issue of whether the requirements, the terms of the commensurate with income standard are applicable to cost-sharing agreements. That is really the only question she asked the government lawyer. It was a two-part question.
That was Patrick Smith, a partner at Ivins, Phillips & Barker in Washington. Pat, like Barb, paid the most attention to Graber's questions since the other two judges had already previously been involved.
The first part was, is the transaction here, that is the cost-sharing arrangement, a transfer or a license of an intangible, which is basically the operative language in the commensurate with income standard. And her second question was, if so, what does that mean? And the government lawyer didn't answer the first question.
It's important to note here that transfer pricing rules in the U.S. require companies to value assets they buy and sell between their foreign units the same way unrelated companies would. That way, the value of the assets between related companies is comparable to the value of assets between unrelated companies. What I just described is essentially something called the arm's length standard, and it's the backbone of transfer pricing. The IRS argues that a sentence in its regulations allows it to use something called the commensurate with income standard. This standard allows the IRS to allocate income between related companies by looking at the income generated by an intangible property, such as trademarks and copyrights, rather than relying on comparable transactions.
Somehow in the oral argument, and even to an extent particularly in the dissent, commensurate with income became this substitute for the arm's length standard or something like that, which I found sort of baffling, because I think that that transfer pricing professionals don't view it that way. You know, they don't view commensurate with income as being something different from the arm's length standard. It's simply an additional thing that a taxpayer has to do when a taxpayer is transferring intangible property.
The sentence that Judge Graber focused on is, in the case of any transfer or license of an intangible property, the income with respect to such a transfer or license shall be commensurate with the income attributable to the intangible.
After the Altura's lawyer expressed the view that it's not, she asked follow-up questions that made it seem pretty clear that she thinks that such a cost-sharing arrangement is, in fact, a transfer or a license of an intangible.
Clearly, the statute requires that if there's a transfer or license of intangible property, the income with respect to it must, under the wording of the statute, be commensurate with the income attributable to the intangible. So if this is a transfer or license of intangible property, the statute requires the commensurate with income principle. Why isn't this a transfer?
And to me, that was really the key moment in the oral argument, because if she believes that, you know, obviously you never know whether a judge is being a devil's advocate or not, but if she genuinely believes that, my expectation is that she will come out for the government.
While Pat and Barb believe that Graber is likely to rule in favor of the government, Calvin Johnson, a law professor at the University of Texas in Austin, is not so sure.
It's very common in opinions in which you will hear the start of the opinion is plaintiff's argument is clearly part of the general rule that has been there forever and ever, and there's a but, i.e. that the judge is going to find for the defendant in this case on a but, and there's some possibility that's what's going on.
Another key moment in the arguments was when Altera's attorney repeatedly reminded the appellate judges of the tax court's expertise.
I think the important foundational point here is that the tax court found that the evidence of third-party conduct here was probative and included comparable transactions, and the Treasury did not challenge that here. They have not challenged the tax court's finding on its grounds. They have instead said that we have the power to redefine the arm's length standard at will, which is another thing that the 15 tax experts in the tax court couldn't find in any of the notices or preamble, that they could redefine the arm's length standard so that it didn't include arm's length evidence.
I think that might have been the point at which I thought he might have overplayed his snarky little hand.
Graber might have made her position known through her many questions, but one thing that was barely discussed during oral arguments was the Administrative Procedure Act. The Act sets out requirements that federal agencies must follow when creating new regulations.
When you watch this oral argument in the Ninth Circuit and the judges basically say nothing about all of that, instead just go straight to the authority issue, it really, I think, sends a very unfortunate message both to the IRS and the Treasury and to the tax court that these procedural requirements aren't important and don't matter.
Many rulemaking challenges arguing similar violations of the Administrative Procedure Act have been popping up, and practitioners predicted that taxpayers will be motivated to raise even more challenges following the first decision issued by the circuit court. This, however, might not be the case.
Seems to me the message is that the IRS and Treasury can basically continue what they have been doing, which is not taking these requirements very seriously.
This type of reaction from the Court of Appeals could make it harder for taxpayers to win on challenges to regulations, and it could also make it less likely that taxpayers will bring those challenges if they get that kind of reaction from the Court of Appeals, Pat told us. Tech giants like Facebook and Google are certainly keeping a watchful eye on the case because it could impact their cost-sharing structures, but tax scholars and practitioners are also interested because of the way the Ninth Circuit dealt with Reinhardt's death and vote.
It's worth noting that this issue in general has generated some controversy among legal scholars about what should happen. And I think there's at least one proposal right now to amend the federal rules of appellate procedure to specify exactly what should happen when a judge becomes unavailable, just to provide more clarity and consistency on that issue.
That was Susan York. She's an attorney at the California Appellate Law Group in San Francisco.
The other thing to note is that even if no federal rule change occurs, it's possible that the Ninth Circuit, sort of seeing that this issue has generated some confusion, is within their power to amend their own rule to try to make it clearer to the public exactly what's happening.
She's talking about Stephen Sachs, professor at Duke Law. He recently submitted a letter to the Advisory Committee on Appellate Rules to consider further rulemaking on which judges get to participate in issuing an order or judgment. This was actually prompted by a recurring issue that he kept seeing in the court. He cites Altera, where the deciding vote was cast by Judge Reinhardt, who passed away nearly 4 months earlier, and therefore generated a lot of controversy, resulting in the withdrawal by the Ninth Circuit Court on August 7th.
There are really some countervailing concerns here about what should happen. One is the question of efficiency. You know, if a case has gone all the way through the process, and everyone has essentially signed on to their position, at that late stage to replace a judge and then sort of redo the whole process might not be the most efficient.
Sachs pointed out a number of ways that the court has dealt with the problem of a judge casting the deciding vote and then suddenly becoming unavailable. 1. A court may add a new judge to a diminished panel. 2. Local rules might require adding an additional judge if the remaining panel judges disagree. 3. An equally divided court could affirm the judgment under review. 4. And finally, as what happened in Altera, a former judge's vote is counted even after he or she left office.
There's also a concern, I think, perhaps about affecting the colleague who has become unavailable, but who fully participated in the case. On the other hand, though, it's important to ensure that the public sort of understands what's happening and understands the process so that it's not seeming like this is just sort of arbitrary or that something unfair is happening.
The Advisory Committee on Appellate Rules will be considering Sachs' concerns during their October 26 meeting. For now, we will have to wait and see just how Graber impacts the outcome in Altera.
Regardless of which way the Ninth Circuit goes, this doesn't strike me as the type of case that would be amenable to being brought to the Supreme Court on cert. Now, if you could generate a split in the circuits, then arguably you might be able to get, although they usually run screaming from tax cases. But if you can generate a split in the circuit, then arguably it could move up and there could be some sort of Supreme Court, you know, consideration of it. I think that's highly, highly, highly unlikely.
With all eyes on this case, Barb expects the panel's going to issue their opinion before the end of the year.
I mean, this is way too important to be fooling around with for months and months. I mean, the opinion came out in July, and now it's October. And now that they've heard, now that they've had the re-argument, you know, one thing I will say is that I would be surprised if it took them longer than till the end of the year.
Thanks so much for tuning in to this final episode of our special edition of Talking Tax. I'm Sony Kasem.
And I'm Carolina Vargas, signing off. We hope you enjoyed following along on this roller coaster of a case.